When I was a medical student, an elderly woman came for consultation about a mass on the side of her jaw. Our hospital was one of the leading hospitals for cancer treatment in the world, and the mass was skillfully identified fast, and state-of-the-art therapy was determined, which involved both chemotherapy and the total removal of her lower jaw. One of the staff doctors went to discuss our findings and recommendations with the woman and her family and schedule the surgery. He returned outraged. The old woman had refused surgery and her family had supported her in this decision. He had explained carefully the almost certain fatal outcome of her sort of cancer without surgery, described the surgery in detail, and given her the statistics of post-operative survival. The old woman had thanked him for his concern and said that she would now go home. All his arguments had failed to move her. Finally, he asked her to sign a paper absolving the hospital and the staff of all responsibility. Calmly, with her family looking on, she had signed. Others had gone to talk with them and with her. Despite enormous pressure from the staff, she left the hospital. She never returned. Her refusal to accept our help left the staff angry for days. Our attitude effectively disenfranchised her with respect to her own life. Yet any of us would have passionately defended her right to vote. Despite her enormous dignity and the obvious love of her family, I remember thinking that they were very strange people. I never found out what lay behind her choice, what had caused her to make her difficult decision with such calm certainty. But 35 years have brought some change, not only to me, but to medicine itself. Recently, after I presented this story to a class of medical students, a second-year student commented that he felt the problem was that the doctors had known this woman's disease, but not the woman herself. Who was she? He asked. She was elderly. Had anyone found out what she had lived by all that time? What was important to her? A fine discussion ensued about the difference between defending a person against death and making a commitment to their life. The students raised some hard questions. How do we serve life? Can we know what is best for people, or do we only know what is best for the treatment of their disease? Is it possible to improve someone's physical health and yet diminish their integrity? The class split right down the middle. Some felt much the way that my own classmates had felt, frustrated, judgmental, and angry. But others thought that the doctors of long ago had diagnosed, but they hadn't understood. They had been rendered impotent, not by the woman's refusal of surgery, but by their own refusal to listen and know who she was. This group of students conceived the task of her doctors not as prolonging her life at all costs, but as enabling her to live her life according to her own values. Depending on who she was, this might include prolonging her life, or it might not. I wonder how these comments might have been received 35 years ago by my classmates and teachers. I suspect not well. Unquestionably, we have missed an opportunity to learn about something far more important than the diagnosis and treatment of cancer, but the capacity to recognize that opportunity lay far in the future.
I thought when I started working on this address that I was going to discuss two issues, some aspects of bullying and why I come to church so infrequently now. But I found as I wrote that I was actually addressing the huge issues of life and God. This is a pretty enormous claim, but given time, I may be able to lead you to where I am in my thinking now. As usual, I start with a story. It occurred at a recent 21st birthday party for a friend from Kangaroo Island. Of course, this meant catching up with many of our other old island friends. Maria, a dear friend who went through a very rough patch just shortly after we left the island, was looking fabulous, bright, bubbly, and full of life. As we chatted, she told me about the changes in her life. After a life-threatening illness, she had had trouble returning to work. Discouraged, she shifted sideways and accepted a job in a related field, doing it well, but not enjoying it as much as she had her original vocation. With a change in the hierarchy at the original workplace, she had been able to return and was enjoying the work more than she'd ever done before. I inquired about the hierarchy change, and another of my very good island friends was named. A story of consistent bullying came out. I was shocked. The friend I knew and the boss she knew seemed to be two different people, and yet I was quite able to believe what I was hearing. Her boss, my friend, is an achiever who expects a high standard of performance from those, from herself and from those around her. Widowed cruelly young, she struggled fiercely with her grief and responsibilities as the sole breadwinner for her two tiny children. Intensely private about that struggle, she is not particularly sympathetic to the effects of life's traumas on other people's ability to perform at their best. Maria could only see my friend as a bully, and certainly the change in the workplace after she left indicates that she was. But was it bullying, or was it a sort of complacency? And is that question really important? The effect on the people she was in charge of was grim, whatever the cause. I have had a similar experience working with a woman whom everyone else considered charming and gracious. For those of us working with her, she was a clever, subtle bully, consistently making us feel belittled and inadequate. But was she deliberately bullying us? Or was she simply oblivious to our feelings? Was she perhaps too complacent about her position so that she was completely unaware of the pain she was causing? Out of this jumble of thoughts, I tried to explain to June what I needed to say. We decided to leave the service untitled. My thoughts were far too complicated to pin down with a formal name. To tell you the truth, I'm still not sure that I have pinned them down, but I've certainly found it a challenge trying to make them coherent. I grew up in a very privileged suburb of Glen Osmond. I went to a privileged private girls' school, and my friends were all of my own social class. I happily developed the same complacent attitudes as my friends had. All this, despite my parents, who grew up in lower middle class Nottingham, went to the local school, and developed very open-minded attitudes along the way. My friends and I were, as far as I can recall, almost totally unaware of, and certainly unconcerned about, the lives of the less privileged children around us. We despised the boys from the nearby technical high school and were extremely prejudiced about the girls from the Catholic college down the road. I can also distinctly remember making disparaging comments to my friends about the children living in Vine Lane and Queen Street, poverty-stricken lanes in the triangle at the top of Glen Osmond and Portrush Roads. We all went to church, We did scripture lessons. We all knew that the poor were blessed. We all put our pennies in the collection boxes for the missions. We all stitched untidy initials on poor quality cotton to make handkerchiefs as gifts for the children at Colebrook Home. And we all felt very virtuous as we enjoyed our own fabulous lifestyles. Does any of that sound familiar to any of you? Interestingly, talking to my husband Bruce about this address, he recalls some quite similar attitudes, although his childhood schooling would have been one of the ones my schoolmates and I despise. He grew up all over Australia. He attended 10 different schools, spending the longest time at Darwin High School. There, the children were a hodgepodge of nationalities: Australian, Scots, Irish, Chinese, Aboriginal, Greek, and a smattering of other nationalities thrown in. The Anglo-Saxon group fought the Aboriginal children, the Chinese fought the Greeks. But when there was a sudden influx of Italian migrants to the town, they all ganged up together to fight the Italians. It would be nice to think we had matured somewhat since those days. I sincerely hope we have, but I do suspect we still allow our very comfortable lifestyles to protect us from the sad reality of so many of the lives around us. I remember clearly a deep conversation with my friend Jackie Cooks, in which we were discussing how to persuade people to move forward in their thinking and choose life for themselves. Jackie said, "Perhaps some folk tread the same path so often they create a groove so deep they cannot see over the sides. Maybe there is a touch of truth in this for all of us." And by that, I mean all of humanity, not just us in this church at this moment, comfortable with or tied down by our own particular lives. We continue to walk the same well-trodden, complacent path, and we cannot see the ways to change. As always, when I find myself tussling with questions that challenge the framework of my life, I turn to books. I reread large parts of If This Is a Man by Primo Levi, and delved into Seven Sins of a Life Worth Living by Roger Houston, which was recommended by a friend. I found this book interesting, and certainly some of it struck a strong chord with my dilemma. Houston writes, "Religious beliefs, beliefs we have about ourselves, about others, about life, construct the world as we know it. They are the stories we tell to make sense of our lives, to give meaning and continuity to our ideas of who we are. We all have beliefs, and we probably can't do without them. Beliefs give us working models through which to engage with the world. But when they exist merely to shore us up, to stave off our insecurities, they prevent us from being fully alive. The more fluid we allow our beliefs to be, the more we are prone to curiosity and even awe." Thinking it over, hearing a far more pompous and wordy statement, Houston has covered almost the same ground as one of my favourite quotes from Ursula Le Guin's book, The Telling. "By literalism, fundamentalism, religions betray the best intentions of their founders, reducing thought to formula, replacing choice by obedience. These preachers turn the living word into dead law." Houston goes on to say of himself, "Most of my adult life has been spent in the company of others who share my views. We all agree that you'd be a fool not to eat organic food when you have the choice, to smoke, to watch television soaps, to eat ice cream in bed. It only makes sense to read uplifting books, to meditate, to work through your neuroses with a therapist, to practice yoga or Tai Chi. I have read the right books, met the right people, travelled to the right places, and had more than a few moments of clarity and insight. I had been growing a spiritual ego that was threatening to marginalise anything that didn't fit into its picture of how things should look." Of his wife Maria, he writes, "She would say only that she loves God in her moment-to-moment experience and is devoted to watching the movement of her own mind. She has shown me that a person's preferences and beliefs are not a measure of who they are,
that a far surer guide is how spacious, non-judgmental and inclusive a person is, first, of all the different parts of themselves and then by extension of others. At about this point, I decided I'd be far more comfortable reading a book by his wife Maria than this one of Housden, in which he refers reasonably constantly to the value of finding the wedge-shaped core of darkness that is oneself through meditation. He also refers to an occasion where I sat on top of Silbury Hill, a crescent moon rising, the chalk land fading into mist along the edge of the horizon, and I felt my place in the wide circle of the human family. I felt the living presence of all those who had been in that land before me and those who are still to come, and I knew that, through time and also through space, we were of one kind. He was about 15 at the time. My goodness. At that age, I doubt I was even aware of the concept of the continuity of time and space, let alone to have had thoughts about my relationship to the whole human family. I decided this man was far too consciously spiritual for me. It seemed to me, too, that his spirituality was very inward-turning, constantly seeking his own inner soul, rarely seeking to serve the teeming life going on around him. I prefer the homeliness of Sister Bernadette, whom I met in an astonishingly vital novel by Diana Noonan called The Wailer's Garden. I'll introduce you to her. "Mr. Crane is a painter," said Mary Agnes. "I suppose you are interested in the scenery here, then," Bernadette suggested, "but I haven't seen you out with your easel." "I am here on retreat, sister." "And why would you not paint on retreat?" she asked. "My meditation consists entirely of painting, though in the winter I sometimes play patience if it's too cold for my fingers to hold a brush." "Sister," Mary Agnes exclaimed, horrified. "It is life," Bernadette replied. "I do not leave God behind when I do these things. At times I regret he cannot be a partner for Euchre." "I think," said Mary Agnes, "that meditation is a time for solitary communion with God." "I quite agree with Bernadette. And how better to contemplate God than with a paintbrush in one's hand, capturing the ridiculous purple of the fuchsia pollen, or the holes punctured in a broad bean's flowers by a bumblebee in search of nectar?" "Besides," said Bernadette firmly, "I find kneeling in my room an idle business. Goodness, in India at the orphanage, there was never time for such things." The narrator of this story describes the beautiful soul as Bernadette, for whom the bergamot danced and the cicadas sang. Bernadette, who fed the rats, who gardened in bare feet, and saw beauty in beans. Bernadette, who knew what was important in this world. Bernadette, I am sure, would get on well with the two churchmen whose examples of how to live and serve the life around them have moulded my soul. Anglican Wilf Chittleborough, whose gentle humour always made a child feel loved and wanted, however solemn the occasion, who had served the community of Maralinga with dedication and love in his youth, and who, with the support of his wife, kept detailed photographic and written records as he died of an extremely rare and utterly cruel form of cancer that ate his skin away, leaving him eventually to die of exhaustion and dehydration from his flayed flesh. This was a final act of service for the people of Maralinga, who had been subjected unknowingly to the complacency of the British government's tests of the effects of radioactivity. Wilf's record and the doctor's reports that go with it continue to be of great value in their fight for recognition and compensation. The other man is Lutheran John Sable, now retired, who was for many years the tertiary chaplain of South Australia. John looked after the congregation on Kangaroo Island as an adjunct to this job, and eventually semi-retired to serve the island congregation alone. Except that he didn't restrict himself to his small congregation. John's philosophy of religion is a world-encompassing one, and his semi-retirement was one of full service to the whole island community. When I went to him, troubled by the fundamentalist approach of the then Anglican minister for the island, I asked John what was special about Lutheranism. He told me that the central tenet of Luther's philosophy, and the one that often got forgotten, was that we come to God through God's own grace. It does not matter how many good works we do, whether we confess our sins, repent, praise, meditate, pray, or don't do any of those things. We only have to believe in God to be accepted by him. So why, I asked, do we do all those things? John lit up with a smile. Because if you believe in a God like that, you'll do whatever you can to become closer to him. Once I commented to him, after reading a book set in India, that Krishna seemed to be very like Christ to me. John smiled again. Of course, surely God is big enough to present himself in different ways to different creeds and races. For a Lutheran, he was a very good Unitarian. Perhaps that's why I felt I was coming home when I first came here. John, like Bernadette, found praying on his knees a waste of time. He prayed when he went fishing. Then he cleaned and distributed his catch to his friends, many of whom were having a desperately hard struggle to provide for their families through the rural recession of the late 80s and early 90s. Thinking about Bernadette and about the influences of Wilf and John on the person I have become, I recognised and was comfortable with much of who I was, and I also began to recognise again how much like my father I am. My father was a leader and an academic of very high repute. He was also an intensely practical man and a committed Christian. He served his God through his rather austere personal moral code, his deep enjoyment of the natural world around him, and through his total commitment to his students. He gave them knowledge, he encouraged them to appreciate the beauty of the art of engineering and the satisfaction of performing to the highest possible standards, and he served their enjoyment of life by participating in and advising them on almost all of the pranks played by the engineering students on Prosh Day during his time at the university. For my father, there was no divide between work and worship, or between prayer and service. They went hand in hand. I am in many ways very obviously my father's daughter. I am very similar to him in looks. I'm often outspoken as he was. I try to maintain a moral code that is a watered-down version of his austerity. And I discovered quite early in my adult life that I had inherited in a small way his talents for leadership and teaching, and a need to express my joy in life and in my God through service. Throughout my life, my ability to teach has taken on a greater or lesser importance as circumstances dictate. Although not trained as a teacher, it was an occupation that was open to me at a time when jobs for women graduates were quite limited, and one I accepted gladly for a few years. On Kangaroo Island, I became involved as a volunteer at the primary school, and for 10 years as the supervisor of the Lutheran Sunday School, which focused on love and enjoyment through a wonderful outreach program. On leaving the island, I believed I'd left my teaching days behind, and I almost forgot the deep pleasure of watching children gain knowledge and achieve through the knowledge. It was then a bit of a shock and a source of delight to be invited to become a teacher again, albeit in a very different setting. This invitation is the reason I rarely appear here on Sundays. You see before you a trainee instructor of the Clare Dog Club, obedience-based dog club, which teaches dog owners how to enjoy their dogs and how much fun it is to teach obedience for both ends of the lead. I thoroughly enjoy this work, and the knowledge I am gaining through working with the other dog owners is actually quite invaluable. Once again, I'm finding great pleasure in serving the members of a small community and seeing the joy a little knowledge can give to people. One of the first people I worked with was Pauline. She came frightened, unsure, with very little self-confidence, wishing to improve her relationship with her much-adored little dog. We all agreed she'd recently undergone some trauma, but chose to support her rather than to pry, to serve her rather than to fix her problems. And as we worked together, Pauline's belief in herself improved enormously. We, the instructors, gained a great deal of pleasure from watching Pauline blossom. Her delight at the effectiveness of the rewards-based methods and the lovely nature of her little dog delighted us, and Pauline quickly became a very valuable, happy, and reasonably confident member of our club. and I personally gained a good, though casual, friendship with a truly gentle woman. In the face of all the tragedies and traumas of the world, the small acts of service enacted at Clare each Sunday morning seem almost pointless. But I'm reminded as I think of them of the story of the man walking along a beach littered with cast-up horseshoe crabs as the result of a storm. Walking along, he'd stoop and toss crabs back into the sea. Another walker remonstrated with him. What was the point, with the thousands of crabs dying on the beach, of bothering to throw a few back? It would make no difference to the impact the storm had had on the population of horseshoe crabs. The first man simply stooped and tossed another crab back into the sea, saying, "Sure makes a difference to that crab." Thinking about my life, I'm a bit like the man with the crabs. I'm a very busy, very ordinary person. I enjoy being busy, and I enjoy serving people around me. And I choose to communicate with my God through that service. I do not carry the aura of great leadership of my father, who, like all great leaders, and I quote, built enduring greatness through a paradoxical combination of personal humility and professional will. But I realise I am choosing life in my ordinariness by giving joy and knowledge to people through serving them. I do enjoy being here in this church, in the friendly, open-minded atmosphere of this congregation. I enjoy the warmth of the services and the thought-provoking addresses. But these are things I do for me. It is good to receive the joy of these services bring, but for the time being, I'm happier living by giving what I can through the small service I can offer to the members of the dog club. And the questions that started me off on this path, the question of bullying, I have no answers there other than to care for the people at both ends of the equation. Maria knows my high-achieving friend only as a bully, but I know her as a person who chooses life. A caring, deeply thoughtful person who'd probably be horrified to know of the effect she had on the people she worked with, and who fought hard to help bring about many changes that have benefited her own community. I feel saddened to have heard of her effects on others, but I wonder if perhaps the answer to my conundrum lies in my choice of words to describe her actions. My friend is probably a helper and a fixer, not a server. I do know I have a tendency to be a fixer too, and that I am as capable of uncaring complacency as she is. I consider myself extremely fortunate that through the influence of my parents and my gentle friends, I have had the opportunity to learn the difference between helping and serving, and been able to discover the gifts I can gain through that service. I hope my present life choices are engineered out of the joy of service and not through complacency, though I suspect the latter just might be the truth. Sometimes it seems rather trite to be gaining so much joy and pleasure through giving service to dogs. Maybe somewhere further down the track of my life, I'll be able to pick up some of the harder challenges again, but maybe not. This present small service may be the one that is right for me into the next stage of my life. So I shall continue to be here in spirit more often than bodily. I'll continue to serve my God through serving the community of my dog club. And I'll look forward enormously to the rare occasions when I can tear myself away from them to come down to join you. I'd like to finish with a reading from The Sparrow by Mary Daria Russell. Philippe Ray sat back on the bench and stared at the ancient olive trees defining the edge of the garden. "There's an old Jewish story," he commented, "that says, in the beginning, God was everywhere and everything, a totality. But to make creation, God had to remove himself from some part of the universe so something besides himself could exist. So he breathed in, and in the places where God withdrew, there creation exists." "So God just leaves," John asked, angry. "Abandons creation. You're on your own, apes. Good luck." "No, he watches. He rejoices. He weeps. He observes the moral drama of human life and gives meaning to it by caring passionately about us and remembering." "Matthew 10, verse 29, Vincenzo Giuliano said quietly, "Not one sparrow can fall to the ground without your father knowing it." But the sparrow still falls, Philippe said.
Many times when we help, we do not really serve. Those who help see life differently from those who serve, and may affect life differently as well. It is hard not to see the person you are helping as someone weaker than yourself, someone more needy. When we help, we become aware of our strength because we are using it. Others become aware of our strength as well and may feel diminished by it. But we do not serve with our strength. We serve with ourselves. We draw from all our experiences. Over the years, I have discovered that everything I know serves and everything I am serves. I have served people impeccably with parts of myself that embarrass me, parts of which I am ashamed. The wholeness in me serves the wholeness in others and the wholeness in life. The wholeness in you is as worthy as the wholeness in me. Service is a relationship between equals. As I serve, I become aware of my wholeness and more accepting of it in using it to serve. I may come to see and understand its power. Many times my limitations have become the source of my compassion. My wounds have made me gentle with the wounds of other people and able to trust the mysterious process by which we can heal. My loneliness has made me able to recognize the loneliness in others, to respect that place where everyone is alone and meet others in the dark. Most humbling of all, I have found that sometimes the thing that serves best is not all my hard-earned medical knowledge, but something about life. I may have learned from my Russian grandmother or from a child. A helping relationship may incur a sense of debt, but service, like healing, a mutual service, is free from debt. The wholeness in me is as strengthened as the wholeness in you. Everyone involved is fortunate to have had the chance to participate, and in helping, we may find a sense of satisfaction in serving. We have an experience of gratitude. Serving is also different from fixing. One of the pioneers of the human potential movement, Abraham Maslow, said, "If all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail." Seeing yourself as a fixer may cause you to see brokenness everywhere, to sit in judgment on life itself. When we fix others, we may not see their hidden wholeness or trust the integrity of the life in them. Fixers trust their own expertise. When we serve, we see the unborn wholeness in others. We collaborate with it and strengthen it. Others may then be able to see their wholeness for themselves for the first time. Perhaps fixing is only a way to relate to things. Relating to another human being in this way is to deny and diminish, in some profound and subtle way, the power of the life in them and its mystery. Over 47 years of illness, I have been helped and fixed by a great number of people. I am grateful to them all, but all that helping and fixing left me wounded in some important and fundamental ways. Only service heals. All who serve, serve life. What we serve is something worthy of our attention, of the commitment of our time and our lives. Service is not about fixing life, outwitting life, manipulating life, controlling life, or struggling to gain mastery over life. When we serve, we discover that life is holy. Service is closer to generosity than it is to duty. It connects us to one another and to life itself. When we experience our connectedness, serving others becomes the natural and joyful thing to do. Over the long run, fixing and helping are draining, but service is renewing. When you serve, your work itself will sustain you, renew you, and bless you, often over many years. The best definition of service I have come across is a single word: belonging. Service is the final heading of healing of isolation and loneliness. It is the lived experience of belonging.